Hello there, I'm Nick Brownlee, and welcome to Nick Brownlee's newsletter, podcast version, episode 1. If you're tuning in for the first time and wondering what the hell's going on, I suggest you go back and listen to Nick Brownlee's newsletter, podcast version, trailer episode. Short and to the point, it'll tell you everything you need to know about this show and why I'm doing it. In fact, go and do it now. Go on. Fucking idiots. Right, now that they've gone, what say we get on with the episode, eh? Well, I thought the best place to start this week would be with some of your letters. And I have to say, you've all been very generous about the podcast, considering you haven't heard it yet. Baz Lohengrin of Sutton Coalfield writes, "Nice to have you back, old son. Let's hope it's funny this time." Yvonne Baxter of Inverness, she says, "I was so excited to hear about your podcast. A little bit of wee came out." Anonymous of Hoxton in East London says, "It would be nice if this show wasn't yet another addition to the vast lake of oral feces that passes for podcasts, but I won't be getting my hopes up." While Mrs. L. Travers of Yarm in Cleveland says, "I hope you're wearing a mask while broadcasting your new podcast. I don't want COVID coming out of my headphones." Well, I'm not Mrs. L, but I am wearing a visor. Harriet St. John of St. Ives in Cornwall, she writes, "I love everything you've ever done, Nick. I love you. We share the same sense of humour. We belong together. Why did you ever marry that bitch?" On a completely unrelated subject, Lucas Merriweather of Fife in Scotland wants to know, "Is a trans woman a man who wants to be a woman, or the other way around? It's fucking doing my head in." Well, it's a difficult one, Lucas. Probably best to see it clear of it, actually. And this from Dave Webster of Birmingham. He writes, "Have you noticed on adverts that they use no-nonsense Yorkshire voices to make products sound trustworthy? I don't know why. I wouldn't trust a Yorkshireman as far as I could throw the self-opinionated, emotionally stunted bastard." Well, that's a bit harsh, Dave, but it's a fair point nonetheless. Are Yorkshiremen more trustworthy than people from other parts of the UK? Is Sean Bean more trustworthy than, say, Michael Caine or one of the Wurzels? And you don't get many Birmingham voices advertising things, do you, Dave? Then again, it's a bit of a stupid accent, isn't it? I mean, you couldn't really take anything someone from Birmingham said seriously, could you? You certainly wouldn't buy anything they were advertising. Clown shoes, maybe, something like that. I've actually been racking my brains for adverts featuring the Geordie accent, and all I could come up with was this.
"Can I take a few bags of Tudor at me wages?"
"Nothing but the best for you, right, lad?"
"Aye, great flavours, Tudor." "Hey, Jack. Deliver these now, dear. Canny bag of crisps."
"Aye, man. The Tudor, a kind of mountain."
Tudor, a crisp that's really worth its salt.
"Pity that lift out of order."
Those were the days. And an interesting fact, the lad who played the paperboy in that advert grew up to have crisp-related coronary heart disease and died of a heart attack aged just 42 while climbing the stairs to his flat on the 20th floor of a tower block in Benwell because the lift was out of order.
"According to my database, you are listening to Nick Brownlee's newsletter, podcast version."
Newsletter episode 1, item 1, never play games with South Koreans. The Ayatollah lost her phone the other day, prompting an exorcist-style meltdown complete with revolving head and projectile vomiting of both ectoplasm and curse words. To cheer her up and to stop the house from shaking, we agreed to forsake our nightly fix of FBI Most Wanted and give her control of the TV for the evening. There was a certain amount of subconscious wishful thinking involved on our part. By gathering together to watch the telly as a family, without the constant distraction of phones, we were, I suspect, hoping to recreate those happy days when our daughter was little and innocent, before she became a fundamentalist tyrant addicted to TikTok. Similarly deluded, we even thought she might choose a nice family film for us all to watch. Grease, perhaps, or Marley and Me. Instead, she chose Squid Game. Squid Game is a 9-part Netflix drama from South Korea. I'd never heard of it, but apparently it's become the must-see show among the Ayatollah's friends. This alone should have raised a red flag. Nothing good has ever come from a program universally adored by 16-year-olds. The second warning sign appeared before the opening credits. The programme we were about to watch, according to Netflix, featured sex, suicide, sexual images, sexual violence references, crude humour, violence and injury detail. But because this cocktail of depravity only warranted a 15 certificate, we let it slide. Surely it couldn't be that bad. Initially, our decision seemed to be justified. The lead character in Squid Game is a loser of pantomime proportions. Divorced, unemployed and living at home with his elderly mother in a hovel in downtown Seoul, Seong-gi-hun is also a hopeless gambling addict. Indeed, the opening 30 minutes, in which he loses all his mother's money on the horses and is pursued by violent loan sharks, is played out in the style of a knockabout comedy, all wide-eyed overacting and pratfalls. Things change, though, when a mysterious stranger offers Gi-hun the chance to earn a fortune by taking part in a series of games. Transported to a remote island, he finds that he is just one of 500 losers similarly tempted by the lure of easy money. So far, so good. But then the games commence, and to Gi-hun's horror, and ours, it transpires that the punishment for losing is to be gunned down by snipers. In the scenes that follow, nothing is left to the imagination. Blood spurts, heads explode, people scream in terror, and bodies pile up by the dozen. And when the shooting is done, guards in creepy face masks dispatch the wounded with a bullet to the head. As the carnage played out on the screen, I glanced over at the Ayatollah and saw a delighted smile playing on her lips. She was, I realized, enjoying every second of this Far Eastern splatterfest. The only minor disappointment was that she didn't have her phone and therefore couldn't tell her friends that they were right and that Squid Game was essential viewing. I won't spoil it by telling you what happens next. Suffice to say, we're now up to episode 4 and pretty much all of the knockabout humour is now a distant memory. And all things considered, it's actually quite good. Although it's convinced me that we should not, under any circumstances, go to war with South Korea.
Sweet Caroline. Bomb, bomb, bomb. Good times never felt so good. Da, da, da. I've been inclined to believe they never would.
Oh, Matthew, you have such a beautiful singing voice.
Thanks, Ravina.
Have you ever thought about turning professional?
No chance.
You should. You would be a big star.
If the lifestyle didn't kill me first. Remember what happened to Rodney?
Rodney?
According to my database, Rodney was a service bot from Vorgan 6, who made it big after winning the X497 Factor.
Yeah. And 3 parsecs later he was found in a hotel room in the Alpha Quadrant. Couldn't speak. Couldn't move. Turned out he'd spent 5 days in a lubricating fluid-fueled orgy, with 9 underage sex droids.
When they opened him up, they discovered that his neural processors had melted.
Oh my goodness. That's terrible. I thought such things only happened to carbon-based life forms.
Not enough of them, in my opinion.
But Matthew, you don't have to have orgies with sex droids.
Then what's the point?
According to my database, there is no point.
I see.
Anyway, who wants to hear my rendition of Copacabana?
Rather you than Barry Manilow. I don't think my oral receptors could stand it.
Her name was Lola. She was a showgirl. With yellow feathers in her hair and a dress cut down to there. Sing it.
At the Copa.
Copacabana.
The hottest spot. North of Havana. Havana.
At the Copa.
Copacabana.
Newsletter episode 1, item 2, a question of ears. The doorbell rang while we were watching episode 2 of Squid Game. It was Dennis from over the road with a bag of lamb chop bones for the dog, still warm from his dinner plate. I thanked him and when he'd gone, dropped the bones straight into the bin as usual. The dog can't eat lamb chop bones, they splinter and get stuck in his throat. I should really tell Dennis this because he keeps doing it, but I haven't got the heart. He's a nice guy and a good neighbour. Rather than upset him, I'll just keep putting his leftovers in my bin. It's no big deal. In any case, I've discovered that the dog much prefers roasted pig's ears. You can buy them at Spar, although they take a bit of getting used to because they look just like, well, pig's ears. Large, hairy and pointed. I always assumed I was the only person who bought pig's ears from Spar, but the other day when I went to buy some, I found to my surprise that they'd run out. Not wishing to disappoint the dog, I drove to Nixon's pet shop in town, but they didn't have any either. All they had were goat's ears, which are similar but curly, a bit like ancient scrolls of papyrus. "Are these the same as pig's ears?" I asked the girl behind the counter. "I don't know," she admitted. Then, turning to a manager, she called out, "Gary, are goat's ears the same as pig's ears?" Gary nodded with the confident smile of a man who'd been asked the same question many times, so I bought a bag of six. Unfortunately, the dog doesn't like them. But then when it comes to ears, he's a picky little sod. Rather than throw them out, I'm thinking of sewing a pair to a hat to scare small children when they come round trick-or-treating on Halloween. Or maybe I'll put them in a bowl and serve them to friends with a salsa dip, just to see what they say. Right, time for more of your letters now, and this week there's only one subject which has been getting you collectively exercised, and that is the Insulate Britain protests, which have brought parts of the motorway system in the south of England to a standstill for the best part of a month. Roadkill Bill, who is an HGV driver from Beeston in Nottinghamshire, writes, "These people are communist scum. The last sound they should ever hear is the roar of a four-stroke turbocharged intercooled diesel engine and the sickening crack as every bone in their body is crushed flat beneath 18 heavy-duty wheels." Wow. Sandy Roberts of Edinburgh, he says, "Insulating Britain is the single most pressing concern of this or any other age. Unfortunately, when I drove down to London to join in the protest, I ended up stuck in a traffic jam for 6 hours because some silly bugger had glued themselves to the M25. Mrs. Maxwell of Harston in Cambridgeshire has been in touch, and she says, "Inspired by the protesters, my husband decided to insulate the loft the other day, but lost his footing on the joists and plunged through the ceiling, breaking his neck. Next time they're thinking of gluing themselves to the M25, maybe Insulate Britain could have a whip round for a specially modified wheelchair and one of those Stephen Hawking robot speech gizmos." Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Mrs. Maxwell, but well, you really should use a professional for things like insulating your loft. And finally this from Doreen McMillan of Hove in Sussex, who says, "For the last 2 years, I've been a full-time carer for my elderly father who suffers from Alzheimer's. He requires constant, round-the-clock attention, and although I love him dearly, in recent months I've been at my wit's end. Last night I drove him to Junction 36 of the M25, put an Insulate Britain placard around his neck, and glued him to the road in the hope that an irate motorist with a tyre iron might just put him and me out of our misery. Does this make me a bad person?" Well, not necessarily, Doreen. I think that we all underestimate how difficult it can be looking after elderly parents, especially those with Alzheimer's or dementia. And if your father could be disposed of in a good cause, in this case, Insulating Britain, then, well, that's something to celebrate, isn't it? Thanks as ever for your letters. Keep them coming. You can find the address in the show notes. But now, time for some music.
Some folks laugh as he walks down the street. His hands are bananas, his melons for feet. But he holds himself with a fruit-like grace.
His fruity cheeks upon his pineapple face.
Here he comes.
The children cry and a juicy tear fall from his loganberry eye.
See him squelch, 'tis the man of fruit. A blame upon his kiwi to glute. Here he is, the man of fruit. Murder on his mind and whose berries in the suit. He's chasing the man that he's gonna shoot. Oh, beware the man of fruit.
The mothers fly to save their kin, aghast at the grapefruit that acts as a chin. And dogs come sniffing around his thighs,
'cause they're both homemade apple pies.
'Tis no like this for an aging man, with the constant threat of being placed in a flan. But today he's bigger fish to fry,
an old enemy who now must die. Here he is, the man of fruit. He enters the bar and begins to shoot.
my God, they shout, he's gone and shot old Reg. Alias, the Man of Veg.
The Man of Veg leaps with a start, his potato hands clutching his cabbage heart. As he falls, he pleads, what did I do? And a radish flies out of his shoe.
Does he recognize the Man of Fruit as his life ebbs out from his beetroot? His shirt of kale begins to soak with the juice of artichoke.
Wipes his blueberry brow and he says, you'll not remember how. At school you were a low-down veggie bum.
You'd flick my grapes and you'd squeeze my plums.
Oh, how you laughed, you loved to mock the small raspberry,
that is my cock.
But now your carrot eyelids droop. Put the pen on, boys! We're having soup!
That was a song called Man of Fruit by a group called the Bemusers, who I must admit I'd never heard of. Apparently they were a folk-slash-gamelan fusion collective formed in the late 1960s, consisting of the late Ned Funnell on vocals and guitar, and also the late Evan Breist on Cheese and Wine. And the reason they're in the news this week is that the song Man of Fruit is at the centre of a bizarre legal battle between representatives of the band and Barbara Broccoli, producer of the James Bond films. Representatives of the band claim Miss Broccoli had agreed to use Man of Fruit as the theme song to the latest Bond film, No Time to Die. Miss Broccoli claims she's never heard of the Bemusers. Well, to discuss this matter and hopefully shed some light on the Bemusers themselves, I'm joined down the line by Clefton Twain, who is president of the Bemusers Appreciation Society and indeed the man behind the legal action. Clefton, thanks for joining me.
That's it's no problem, Mick. No problem.
Good. First of all, what's the latest with this, quite frankly, bizarre legal claim?
I'm a big fan, as you know, of the Bemusers. I mean, I am. I followed them for 60 years now, 60 years, and they are a massively underappreciated band. Really, one of this country's biggest musical groups, and what they've done over the years has been fantastic. And the one thing that they've never managed to do is a song for a Bond film. And this film was coming out. I saw there was a delay. There was a delay because of COVID, obviously. And I saw my opportunity. So I got in touch with this woman, and I said, I've got the ideal song for you. It would be absolutely a great fit. What better way to celebrate Bond and all his sort of his spying ways than a song about a man of fruit? And I sent this note. I sent her the tape, and she didn't come back to me, which I thought was going to be a really that was positive. You know, there was no rejection there. And next thing I know, they've chosen some other bloody song. And I'm thinking, fuck that. You've got the song. And so then I'll go in big with my mate, you know, my lawyer mate. And we're taking them down and they're going to use this song. I know they've had a fucking premiere, but that's shit. That's not... They're going to have to replace it with Man of Fruit.
So Clefton, if I can just clear this up, then you were saying that to win this legal action, you would insist that Barbara Broccoli and the Bond producers withdrew the film, re-edited it with Man of Fruit as the theme tune.
Well, they have to, don't they? Now they have to. Within the song there, which I think you've just played. You see there's a bit there about, it's a bit of antagonism between fruit and vegetables. And I wonder whether the fact that she's called broccoli, I wonder whether that's a thing here.
Well, yeah, yeah. I was going to come to this. I mean, the song itself, it was the first time I've heard it was just now. It appears to be about a man made of fruit who is on some sort of revenge mission against a man predominantly made of vegetables.
It's classic Bond.
Well, yeah. I suppose it's sort of in a way it encapsulates the entire Bond canon. Really, it's sort of one man against an evil man.
He's in the fruit camp. That's clear from his whole his name and all the bits of that he's made of, which is fruit.
Yeah.
So that's where he is, and he's a standalone man there of fruit, and he's going along. Mm. He walks into a bar there, and what the song doesn't say, and what I think Ned in his lyrics was gonna have in there was about him. He was gonna order a martini, wasn't he? And he was gonna go shaken, not stirred, and all that Bond bit. But then he got mixed up with a fight and everything. So he shoots. If they carried on the song for another verse, is what I'm saying, he would have gone up and he'd say, "I'll have a martini," and it'd be shaking, not stirred, and fucking hell, boom. There you go. Bond song.
It's interesting because, obviously, Daniel Craig as Bond has gone a long way to sort of making him more a sort of vulnerable character. And I'm just looking at the lyrics here, or some of the lyrics. It starts off, "Some folks laugh as he walks down the street, his hands of bananas and melons for feet. But he holds himself with a fruit-like grace, his pruny cheeks upon his pineapple face." And then later on, it says, "The mothers fly to save their kin, aghast at the grapefruit that acts as a chin, and dogs come sniffing around his thighs, because they're both homemade apple pies." And there is a sort of innate sadness about the man.
Exactly. And I don't know what you know about the Bermudas.
Nothing at all.
Okay, well, Ned Funnell, who was a sort of guitarist and percussionist, which was a challenge sometimes, but he started off as he was a porter in a fish market, in Billingsgate Fish Market, and he then met Eben Breest. Because he was delivering the fish. Sorry, this isn't a tangent. It may feel like it's a tangent, but it's not. I'm going back to the 60s.
Yeah.
What was the question again?
I can't remember, and it's not very important. I'm interested that you're the president of the Bermudas Appreciation Society.
Correct. That's correct.
And how many members are there in the Bermudas Appreciation Society?
Well, for a long time, it was just me, officially. You've got to put this into context that there were hundreds of people interested and loved the Bermudas music, hundreds, probably maybe 104 or something like that. But they didn't realise there was a fan club. But I was running anyway. It was pre-internet. It was pre-email. I phoned a few people, but I couldn't really get anyone in. But anyway. There was lots of people involved. Well, there was me, but my wife, so she was member number two for a while, and she was enthusiastic about, leafleting and all that. So we tried to get more people, and then she's my ex-wife now. She left, and my shed burnt down soon after she left. That was why I had all my bloody memorabilia in there, and then she fucked off. And there's still just me. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
Still just me.
Yeah.
So one.
So they're basically, you're saying that there only ever was you.
They're a very popular band, very misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
Some thought they were racist. They weren't. They weren't racist. They were misunderstood.
Well, actually, Clefton, while you mentioned that, you mentioned they are misunderstood. I've managed to unearth this rare recording, in fact, of Ned and Evan being interviewed about the band and their influences on Radio Lincolnshire back in 1978.
More than what I did, like, because he's living up there. He didn't get bloody lot away, boy.
No. They weren't going to anyway. They weren't going to, Mark.
Well, they cheering clubs. I always remember the...
Yeah, oh, yes.
There were old Dr. Pepper or Dr. Flip or what, I don't know what bloody name.
Yeah.
Lived up somewhere or other.
There you go. There you go, Mick.
But what I'm interested in, Clefton, is, you know, why you're so interested in them. Because as I understand, Man of Fruit was the B-side of a song initially called I've Got No Buttocks, which I understand reached number 268 in the charts in 1975. And that was the highest chart position the band ever achieved. And nobody I've ever spoken to, or other than you, appears to have heard of them or indeed like their music.
You don't get to number
268
without more than one person. Come on, let's be honest. I mean, and look, they went on for years and years, the Bermudas. You don't do that without having any fans. And I would follow them everywhere. And they used to play in village halls everywhere.
Yes, but as I understand it, Clefton, they did go on for years and years without any fans. They appeared in village halls. Nobody turned up. They booked various venues and nobody turned up. And they were possibly the most unsuccessful band in the history of music.
They were just the absolute quintessential. I'll use that word advisedly because I don't know what it means. But they were absolutely the, I'll say it again, quintessential.
Mm.
The sort of what music was about. It's about the performers. It's not about the audience. Mm. And that's what they did.
Okay, just one more question before we go. Thanks very much for your time.
I've got plenty of time. It's all right.
Well, I'm afraid I don't. And, you know, life is indeed too short to be speaking to you for much longer.
Go on then.
Well, the one final question is, we're talking over Zoom and obviously I can see you. Why are you wearing no clothes?
Well, it's a Sunday, isn't it? It's a Sunday afternoon, and I like to sort of I'm a hard worker. I'm a hard working man. I spend the week working. You don't want to know what I do. You really do not.
No, I don't actually. No,
suffice to say, the work is of such a nature that it's best to remove my clothes at the weekend. So I feel that if I remove my clothes, I feel purified. And come Monday morning, I'm ready to go again with a job, which, as I say, you do not want to know why.
Well, that's very good of you to tell me, Clefton. And listen, thanks ever so much. And best of luck with the legal case against Barbara Broccoli and with the Bermudas Appreciation Society. I don't think we'll be playing them ever again or even speaking their names. But, you know, I do appreciate what you're doing.
Well, that's unfortunate. But yeah, get your listeners or your viewers, you get them to you know, join my campaign, which I'm calling... I'm sort of thinking that up on the spot, really, but I think we should have a campaign called Get. I'm going to keep it short, so Get Man of Fruit as to replace the existing.
Sorry, Clefton. Yeah, you were saying. Are you okay?
I've just caught something there. This is the problem when you've got no clothes on. Mrs. Broccoli to replace the existing song for No Time to Die and make it Man of Fruit and probably refilm the start credits. They can do that, and I think that's the campaign people can get behind.
Brilliant. Clefton, best of luck. Thanks very much for joining us. Clefton Twain there. He is the president and only member of the Bermudas Appreciation Society. And if you'd like to lend your support to his campaign, you can sign up at the following website, www.getmrsbroccolitoreplacetheexistingsongofnotimetodieandmakeitmanoffruitandprobablyrefilmthestartcredits.co.uk. Well, that's about it for Nick Brownlee's newsletter, podcast version, episode one. Hope you've enjoyed it. Got to start somewhere, haven't you, I suppose? Before I go, just time to give you my cultural recommendation of the week. And if you're a fan of Vic and Bob, then I heartily recommend Bob Mortimer's recently published autobiography entitled And Away. Bob's become something of a national treasure in recent years, and this book tells the story of how he got there from unpromising beginnings working as a bin man in Middlesbrough to his long-running comedy partnership with Vic Reeves and his life-changing heart surgery back in 2015. It's out in hardback, but I suggest you get the audiobook, which is read by Bob himself, complete with daft voices and barely suppressed laughter. It certainly kept me giggling away as I walked the dog of a morning. Meanwhile, all being well, I'll be back with more of the same. Hope you'll join me. My thanks to the Bemusers, Clefton Twain and Scott Curtis for additional material in this episode. Nick Brownlee's newsletter podcast version is a Paperfoot production. Thanks for listening. See you soon. Paperfoot.